Hello, welcome to the podcast. I'm back with my co-host, Rabbi Shimon Felix, and we have a special guest today, Dr. Shlomo Fischer, who's taught at Hebrew University. I believe you're a sociologist by profession.
That's correct.
And has studied Israeli politics, wrote his doctorate on a subject which is very close to Israeli politics, and very basically a lot about Merkaz HaRav Kook, which we'll talk about during the podcast. And naturally, the subject of our podcast today is the Israeli election. So without further ado, I'm going to ask the $64,000 question. And besides who's going to win the election, which we're not going to engage in predictions today, what's at stake? And Shlomo, I know for a number of years, worked in the Israeli school system to promote democracy. So I'll turn to you and ask you, what's at stake in this election?
How's that going?
That was an interesting introduction.
Go ahead, Shlomo.
Okay, so first of all, this election is shaping up to be basically a referendum on Netanyahu. And therefore, that's why the, let's say, the satellite parties or the smaller parties that are in each block are may get crushed on Tuesday, and because people will either vote either for Likud or for blue and white, as the two opposing contending main contending parties go. So that's about the structure of this election. It's a little bit unusual in Israel, but Israeli politics has been tending towards this for the past number of years. They've raised the electoral threshold and stuff like that, all of which tends to crush the smaller parties that used to characterize the Israeli system. From my partisan point of view, and you asked me what's at stake, so that calls for a partisan response. From my partisan point of view, I think that Netanyahu very, very slowly, very, very carefully, but he's testing out to what extent he can implement authoritarian populist policies in Israel. And in general, authoritarian populism, as it's worked out in Europe, as it's worked out in Hungary, as it's worked out in Poland, as it's worked out in other places, tends to curtail those safeguards very slowly, and many times you don't know what's going on because these are all technical things that people do, how Supreme Court justices are selected or things like that. He's testing out how to remove the safeguards that will protect minorities, that will protect individual rights, that will protect those things, and going down the path of a majoritarian democracy, in which there's less emphasis. I wouldn't say that there's no emphasis, but there's less emphasis on liberal individual rights, minority protection, and stuff like that. So if you ask me what's at stake, that to me seems could very well be at stake, especially given that there's a conflation in this election, more than in other elections, between Netanyahu's personal situation, personal legal situation, and the legal reforms, etc., that the people on the right have been talking about, that Shaked has been talking about, that Yariv Levin, his minister of tourism, has been talking about, and other people like that.
Shimon?
Let me pick up where Shlomo left off. I agree that Bibi seems to be slowly chipping away at liberal democracy. But I don't think he sees it works. If being more liberal and more democratic would work, he'd do that. So it's not as if it's not like Trump or some of the people in Europe where I think there's some sort of either commitment or psychological tendency towards a more authoritarian kind of government. I think Bibi just wants to do what works. And this seems to be what works all around the world right now. for all kinds of reasons, or maybe one or two big reasons, I'm not exactly sure, the world seems to be turning to, I would say unintelligent, but Bibi is not unintelligent, and Boris Johnson went to Oxford, but somewhere they're unintelligent. There's some deep unintelligence there.
Boris partied a lot at Oxford.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. Maybe the alcohol did something to his brain cells. I don't know. But the world seems to be turning towards these authoritarian figures that we can trust, who are charismatic to many people, not me. I wouldn't want to spend a minute with any of these people. I think it's a lot about personality. I don't think Bibi really cares that much. He gave the Bar-Ilan speech where he showed a willingness to a two-state solution. And now he sees that annexation of the West Bank seems to be where we're going, so he's embracing that. It's all very cynical. And now one can understand his cynicism. He wants to stay out of jail. You know, I get it. I used to get it less. Now I get it more. So I think there is a threat to our democracy, to a liberal democracy here. But I don't know. There is something very robust about many aspects of Israeli democracy. Everybody says whatever the hell they please. The media is, you know, very rough and ready. So I'm not that worried. I'm a little bit worried. I'm not that worried. How long am I in? A minute and a half? I'm much more worried about Trump's America.
Okay, well,
much more worried about Trump's
America. We'll intervene.
America.
We're going to have an intervention about
before
that.
I go off on Trump's America.
I'll just say briefly, I'm more worried, I'm more worried because it's not only Netanyahu. I mean, when the only figures in Likud who come out are ex-Likud or, you know, Likud people in the past, Benny Begin, you know, of the relatively immediate past, and these type of people come out, and no one within the Likud party, no one wants to. I'm not talking about the leaders who, the presumptive leaders to take his place, but even lower level people. I mean, part of it is fear that for the rest of their lives, if they say anything wrong against Bibi, they're going to be, for the rest of their lives, they'll be persona non grata wherever they go. But the fact that you have this whole manganon, and no one can come out against the leader, I find that a frightening thing. In other words, that's not only Bibi. And then you have someone like Engelmann, who has decided that the comptroller's office, the Mevaker HaMedina, shouldn't deal with any corruption issues, which is, you know, was the part and parcel. It was like one of the crown jewels of Israeli democracy, that no matter who you are, at some point, if the Mevaker is at all decent, you're going to be called out. There is going to be an investigative body. So doing away with these type of things. And then one more thing about what you said, which is true, is the robust press. But we have to remember that the robust press, who's been denounced by him and his acolytes on a regular basis, leftists, etc., basically he's done a fantastic job of trying to take over the media, starting from Sheldon Adelson and the Bibitron to take over Gahalei Tzal, which has been a big success. To having billionaires control various TV stations, taking over the state TV stations and radio. He's really succeeded at that and to an unprecedented level. So I guess I'm a bit more worried. We'll leave it at that in my own fears, but I think we're kind of all of one piece to some degree at what's at stake in the election. Coming about that, I mean, Shlomo said, and I'll say, you know, and you said too, Shimon, is one of the big issues is Bibi saving himself via this election. That's kind of, for him, obviously a very big election. Are there any other issues out there that the voters care about? You know, yes, Bibi, no, Bibi. Is there anything else behind that that's motivating them to vote the way they're voting? Shimon?
Look, I think Bibi has successfully positioned himself, strangely enough, although it makes some sense, as Mr. Security, even though the situation on the Gaza border is the same as it always been, not very good, not very bad, but not very good. The threat from the north is very serious. The West Bank, you know, the terror, every once in a while pops up. You know, nothing's really changed, but he's managed to position himself as Mr. Security. And most of his opponents have managed to make most Israelis feel that they don't have that going for them, that they're not to be trusted the way Bibi is, to keep a cool head and to say what needs to be said on the international, in the international arena. And there's something to it. Look, you can't take away from Bibi his very real accomplishments. And this is where I think he is better than the Trumps and the Johnsons and that guy in Hungary, Orbán. I think he's better. Israel really is doing very well on a lot of fronts. There's no, you know, no denying it. Even his palling, you know, his cozying up to Putin and Trump, what choice does he have? I mean, really, Israel is a very small country. We're not England, we're not France. I don't think that he has much choice. He seems to maybe to enjoy it too much. But I think he's doing, on many fronts, a very good job. And the average Israeli is most concerned, and has always been most concerned, with security. And somehow he feels like a guy who will bomb the Syrians when he needs to bomb them, and the Iranians now, and maybe the Russians soon, who knows. Whereas the other guys, you know, Kahol Lavan, the Blue and White Party, I don't know, there's something there, and Bibi plays on this in his electioneering, there's something there that makes you feel they really seem to not be ready to run the country. Even though mostly generals there, but generals don't make policy, and generals don't talk to foreign leaders, etc. So I think, yes, it's all about Bibi, and the average Israeli is quite nervous on an existential level about, you know, all those missiles out there waiting, you know, pointed at us. And Bibi has done a good job of convincing us that he can handle it.
Shlomo?
Well, I mean, first of all, I mean, we did point out in the previous round that, you know, there is behind the personalities, there is an issue of how Israel is legally, constitutionally run. I mean, we talked about more or less threat to liberal democracy, etc. I would point out that, you know, with all that, I mean, Kahol Levan and Blue White got 35 mandates last time, and the fact that they have an explicit right wing, Yalon and Boaz Hendel and other people, they have an explicit right wing, is supposed to reassure the Israeli electorate, and it seems to work to a certain extent. Whether it really, really works, whether they'll win, that's a whole different question. And it seems to work to another extent. We haven't mentioned, by the way, the Joker in the pack, and the guy who acted as the Joker in the pack was, of course, Lieberman. Mm-hmm. And Lieberman brought out in this election, at least for a while, he brought out the whole issue of religion and state. And he brought out the whole, I mean, we're having another election supposedly because the Haredim don't go to the army. I mean, nobody's heard about that since, you know, since April.
They don't go to the army.
But, you know, but that was the so-called efficient cause for why we had, you know, why we're having this election and this whole, and Gantz and Blue and White is talking about a national unity secular government, and that's the new bon ton. There is something there about what kind of state do we want, what kind of Zionism do we want? Do we want a religious Zionism? Do we want a state, at least in regard to public issues of national issues, of territory, of Eretz Israel, of things like that, have a more of a religious construction, or do we want, you know, and how about what's the place of the rabbinate, personal autonomy, the ability to get married and divorced as you see fit?
Let me say quickly two things. The last thing you said about personal autonomy, etc., strangely and unfortunately, I don't think the average Israeli cares that much. It seems to me that the people who make a lot of noise about how ridiculously awful the rabbinate happens to be are people like you and me and Leon, you know, sort of...
No, the statistics are pretty clear here about people who are not using the rabbinate. And it's, and the curve goes in a downward slope.
I agree. But I think that's just a question of not wanting to have an unpleasant experience. I don't think it goes as far as I really think we should do things politically, and I'm going to vote in a certain way to undo the rabbinate and take away its power. I don't see that as a real motivator for people to
vote. There's a lot of...
I think that the issue, I don't think the issue is the rabbinate per se. I think people are saying, you know, I was at a political meeting of a political party, so I can't say which one. I'll post on Facebook with a t-shirt in due time. And people were talking about, you know, just my freedom to see my relatives on Shabbat because, you know, big Kiddush, you know, people don't, I remember that was the first thing when I came to yeshiva, and people were talking, you know, moderate people were talking about Shabbat and we got to keep Shabbat the way it is. And I go, hey, what if you don't can't afford a car and you work 5, you know, days a week and your only day to go see your relatives is Shabbat and you want to, and you can't afford a taxi and you want to be able to take a private bus to do it? I think these things are even more bother people. People, younger people are saying, you know, the older generation, even if secular Israelis, well, that's the way it always was. Shabbat is Shabbat. And young people are saying, no, I don't have the money for a car. I want to go do this on Shabbat. Why isn't there a bus? I mean, I think that these type of things, and I want to get married this way, and I don't want people telling me that way. It's not the Rabbanut per se is this kind of body. And the other thing I think with the Haredim is, I have to, we'll get into it in a moment, but about ads and campaigns, but the Haredim ran one of their totally misleading ads, which said, look, the yeshiva budget is like a fraction of 1%, and that's what's going to yeshiva. And is that what you're really worried about? That's what you're trying to kill, and you're killing Am Yisrael, and we're playing nice music, and you're so upset. No, you have studies of the Otsar. They don't do it because, you know, they don't excite people that say, look, we're going to lose tens of billions of shkalim in productivity. And the country is going to slowly become like a third world country when you have the Haredi population now 50% of the men. It didn't go back down. It went back up. We're not working and are not productive. So I think it's a wider issue of personal liberty. It's an issue of now people are finally getting it, the economics of it and the situation. So I think it's larger.
I mean, there's a cycle that happens in Israeli politics that when the Haredim, you know, are the linchpin in any government, they play to the hilt. They always play to the hilt, and then people get disgusted with that, and you know, and the media, right, of course, plays against them, and then people say, okay, until here, and then they haven't had it the last time in 2015. You know, before that election, we had Lieberman, Bennett, and Lapid went together. You know, against the Haredim, they passed the law about enlisting Haredim into the army and all that other stuff. So you know, so there seems to be a cycle that the Haredim get in. They play too much. They can't restrain their appetite because they can squeeze Bibi as much as they want.
Yeah.
And then people get disgusted, and I've noticed that in the rhetoric that in the interviews, Gabi Ashkenazi from Blue and White and other people, you know, Memshelet Schita,
the sure.
61, you know, it's a blackmail government. In other words, that the Haredim will squeeze, yeah, and squeeze and squeeze and squeeze. That seems to be effective.
Well, you know, what you just said made me think of something. I think Israelis tend to be, in many, many areas, on the horns of some real dilemmas. The way you just described the kind of a pendulum effect where the Haredim seem to chaparayim, you know, they grab so much when they can, and that sort of disgusts the populace. But then there's a kind of a rethink. After all, we do want people to be studying Torah, and we do want there to be a Shabbat, and it sort of goes back and forth. And the pendulum bit is not so interesting to me. What's interesting to me is I think most Israelis can't really decide between those two positions. And I think that sentence, most Israelis can't really decide between, is true about a lot of issues. I think the big issue of the West Bank and Gaza and what to do, most Israelis, and this is not the first time I've said it, and I've heard many other people say it and write it, sort of understand, maybe less now as time goes by, but sort of understand that a two-state solution is the only thing that feels like a long-term solution, and yet think that it may well end in disaster if we go that route, that there'll be hundreds of thousands of dead Israelis, not just thousands. And so we sort of also bounce back and forth between basically certainly embracing, back in the 70s, the Egyptian peace process, sort of embracing Oslo, very much embracing the peace with Jordan, and then what you have now, the years go by, there's no real peace. The terror pops up every once in a while and reminds us. Gaza keeps reminding us of what might happen. And so we swing back and forth in a kind of a constant pendulum, an eternal pendulum within us of wanting both, of having not being able to decide where to go on these really difficult, these are difficult decisions. You know, other countries tend to not have that many difficult decisions.
You have it with the migrant workers, the migrants from Africa. These are difficult decisions. What should we, you know, it's smaller in scope, but what do you do with it? There are good arguments on both sides. And the same with many, many issues. I pity the poor Israeli. I pity us in a way, in that we really are finding it hard to make up our minds between very difficult opposite positions, opposing positions.
There's one thing. I disagree with Shimon. I think maybe I disagree with the elements of Bibi's success. I don't think he's responsible for Israel's high-tech prosperity. I think also with regard to agreements with foreign leaders, charming them, not charming them, for example, I think it has to do with a confluence of interests, let's say with Arab countries and with Russia. And like people point out, when Russia tells us we can't bomb or operate in Syria, Bibi doesn't say that. When Putin says, no, you can't do this, and our freedom is severely restricted to a degree which it hasn't been before, it doesn't come across as a policy failure. But I do agree, I think, with both of you, particularly with Shimon, that the issue is that so many of the Israeli voters are afraid. And for even though there's all these generals in Kohol V'Lavan, they trust Bibi. And it's interesting that I think that now I come to see that it was, I think, in retrospect, a disastrous decision. I'm just surprised that I'm finally doing tshuva and saying it, which was giving Gaza back. Was I think that from a military, geostrategic, whatever fancy word you want to use, when we're facing all these missiles, it's not like the West Bank where we can go in. And it's not even in certain ways like a completely foreign Arab state that we can be at war with. It's something that under international law, we're kind of responsible. The world sees us as kind of like occupying still Gaza. We're in like the worst possible position. And yet they have all these missiles to attack us. But I just, to close it off, I just, you know, remembered, yeah, it was Ariel Sharon, a right-wing guy, who did it. And there was a piece in Haaretz, which is interesting, because everyone, the $64,000 question is, why did Ariel Sharon do what he did? And so they have a quote.
Out of jail.
They have a, well, yeah, I don't believe that, but, I mean, that was...
it's a possibility.
It's a possibility. Manny Mazouz, who had, you know, it doesn't matter, we won't get into it, you know, they decided whatever, but his son getting millions of dollars that they couldn't tie it directly to Sharon. But Weissglass is quoted. It could be that it was, like you said, it's all untrue, that we'll give them back Gaza and that'll enable us, that'll be the morsel to keep the West Bank basically permanently. So we'll keep the crown jewel of what we want to keep and we'll give them back this Gaza. And, you know, whether that's true or not, but it's interesting that I think that the issue, I mean, there is also Oslo. But Gaza, which is now a real, real super threat, wasn't done by a left-wing government. It was done by a right-wing government. And again, the fact that you see Netanyahu, did you see in everyone in replay at least his speech and having to exit the under rocket attack?
Yes.
Okay. So that could happen to anyone.
I think that Netanyahu was in fact very glad that we gave back Gaza.
Right.
I think that has a tacit partnership with Hamas.
Right.
That as long as that's why he doesn't want, you know, the people calling for better or for worse, I'm not sure this is a great idea, but the people calling for, you know, the destruction of Hamas, such as Gabi Ashkenazi and those guys in blue and white.
Right.
For Netanyahu, it's very convenient.
Right.
In other words, as long as there's Hamas and
there's no state,
Palestinian authority, you know, there will never be a peace process because there's no partner to talk to. And I think so. He's very happy about that, and I think this is a strategic decision on his part to keep Hamas, you know,
in power,
you know, in a bad position, but in power, not to. And he just gives enough leeway here and there with the fishing and, you know, 3 kilometers, 10 kilometers, 4 kilometers, you know, all that stuff, just enough to keep them there, but of course not enough to endanger. I think that for the average Israeli, life is not bad. And I think I agree with Shimon in terms of that. And listen, you know, Napoleon used to ask about generals, does he have luck? You know, so I don't care whether it's Netanyahu's fault or not Netanyahu's fault. It's credited somehow to Netanyahu's watch. I think that there's been tremendous mobility on the part of the Mizrahi middle class. You see that almost every place at this point, the last statistic that I saw is that a second generation Mizrahi, if you discount all the other factors, education, makes 90% of what second generation Ashkenazis makes. In other words, so the gaps, and this has been continuously every year, they close further and further and further. So there's a sense of, that's why I think that the Oli Levy and all that stuff with Amir Peretz
doesn't make any headway.
Old stuff. Yeah. Doesn't make any headway. And I think most Israelis are prosperous. I think that there's a minimum of terror, mainly because the Palestinian Authority, you know, is as afraid of it as we are, so they cooperate no matter what. And that used to be,
by the way, highlighted under different regimes besides Bibi, or the Ramat Kalim, former chiefs of staff,
right,
during their tenure, and people who were the general in charge of Yehuda and Shomron would praise the Palestinian Authority for their security cooperation. We never hear that these days. It's strangely enough. I mean, more or less, but it occurs, right?
Yeah. I think that it occurs. And so, I mean, you know, at least on the immediate range, you know, why change it? You know, and Bibi didn't do the one thing which seems to be a necessary and sufficient condition for change of regime in Israel. For the most part, he didn't lose a war.
Yeah.
In other words, and if you look at, you know, the one sin that any statesman, politician, whatever, can do in Israel is to lose a war. I mean, in the sense that Israelis view losing war, Yom Kippur War or Second Lebanon, and two things will happen to you. A, listen, there are always, anybody can get, any politician can have corruption charges against them. I don't believe that anybody is set that clean that you can't bring something. So you lose a war, and two things will happen. A, they'll bring corruption charges. That's what happened to the Marach. And this, in the 70s,
yeah,
that whole thing that started with Yadlin and cascaded into all these investigations and people going off for committed suicide, all that stuff. And then with Olmert. I mean, Olmert was perceived as having lost the Second Lebanese War, rightly or wrongly. I'm not sure he did, but there was a perception of that sort, and he was prosecuted, and Kadima disappeared as a political force.
I just want to make sure I'm getting what you're saying. Are you saying that there was somehow some political motivation behind his prosecution?
I'm sure that he was guilty, and I'm sure that had he won the war in flying colors, everybody would have ignored it.
Yeah, it's not exactly political. I don't think it's political motivation. It's rather the desire is there, more so than if, as Shlomo said, he was a hero.
Yeah, because I don't believe we should. I don't. We can talk about it, but I think that when I meet highly intelligent people who are good friends of mine, and they say that the police, along with the prosecution, have cooked up the charges against Bibi. They've unduly influenced the witnesses. It's all a political plot to get him. Mendelblit, or I like to call him Mendelschlecht, is weak, and I go, this is destroying the foundations of the state. We talked about democracy and stuff, and I just can't engage in these kind of conspiracy theories. Like, I think Olmert was guilty of sin, and when you build the Holy Land top towers and you do that to the skyline of Jerusalem, that isn't a minor thing, you know.
The whole city is scratching its head. Who bribed
everyone
to build that
thing? I remember getting a tram from Gush Etzion, and I was so naive. And I was talking about with someone who gave me the tram, and he said, Zalokarastam, Kumar, this was before it all exploded. It was well known amongst a lot of people that there was a lot of corruption. So I've got to disagree with that kind of thinking. I think it's dangerous. And having at least been in the civil service, being a lawyer in the civil service, the people who are in the Prakritut are people, career people, are... they may have political points of view, but they are highly apolitical when it comes to their work. They don't get paid enough. They're in there because they actually believe what they're doing. And I find it very hard to believe that the police, which are still not a great Ashkenazi organization, they're not all the elite Ashkenazim, are there to get Bibi. I find that hard to believe.
I'm saying that the mechanism, I mean, I don't think specifically that this, in terms of Bibi,
right,
that there is that mechanism, but I think that in the past, it has operated, and I think there's a tendency for it to kick in when
they lose a war.
When they lose a war.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not going to press the point. Shimon, I'll turn to you. We have the beauty contest. And I knew that we were both impressed by one of the commercials that who ran, in your opinion, the best campaign of the parties. You don't have to rate every single party, but if you there was some parties that you thought were worth mentioning. Anyone? You're going to say no one ran a good campaign? There's no one to talk about?
I don't know. I think Bibi's Gewalt campaign, where we're losing and we're not going to win. If you don't get up and vote, we're going to lose. Is actually, you know, there's a logic to it. It makes sense. It seems to have worked in the past. It seems to, you know, sort of orient his base and a little bit beyond his base. So, you know, if you want Bibi, vote for Bibi. It's pretty simple. The, you know, the talk against everyone as being a lefty and a lefty and this one's a lefty and that one's a lefty. It, you know, smacks of a kind of McCarthyism. It's a little silly. At the end of the day, these guys who are right-wingers by any stretch of the imagination. But look, that, all right, you know, I don't know, the Shas campaign with the, you know, playing on religiosity and going to heaven if you vote for us, and Ovadia Yosef will give you a blessing up in heaven if you vote for us, is grotesque. But it's grotesque in my theology, in my understanding of Judaism. It's exactly the way the Judaism of many of my co-religionists here in Israel works, where they do like intervening tzaddikim and intervening people up in heaven to pray for them. And if you believe that Shas really does do good, so vote for Shas, you're helping them do good. So there's, again, a logic to it, but I find it grotesque. And also, they're so phony. I mean, I can't get the picture of Aryeh Deri putting onions to his eyes to help him cry over Ovadia Yosef's death. It's on tape. You can see it.
I saw it.
People still, the thing that gets me when you ask me about campaigns,
right,
is the nonsense that people fall for, you know, which is why I began by saying, look, Bibi says, if you don't vote for me, we'll lose. Is a reasonable thing? That bit is reasonable. But the nonsense that people fall for is, it's disheartening. When you think of how stupid people can be. I don't know.
Shlomo, do you have any picks, top favorites?
Well, I think that Bibi, on certain occasions, overplayed his hand. And he overplayed the thing with the cherem or the excommunication of Channel 12. And he was apprised of the fact that backfired. So there are a number of things like that that he did that I think basically backfired and didn't present him in a positive light. That does not mean that his last minute campaign, you know, that if you don't vote for me, we're going to get the Arabs and the leftists in here and it's going to be the end of the country. That won't work. It could very well work. I mean, I tend to think that the turnout will be, that the result will depend upon turnout. I don't think that people who are Bibi supporters, I don't think if they, even if they have, you know, if they say, well, you know, this is a bit too much, or, you know, everything with Bibi is a little bit too much, that's not going to cause them to vote for the opposition. They'll never vote.
But they might stay home.
Yeah. And the opposite. You know, in other words, and if people say, you know, Gantz, you know, who the hell is Gantz? You know, he's a very pale figure. I don't want him to be, I can't imagine him as Rosh Hashanah. So they'll stay, you know, so people in Tel Aviv will stay home. You know what I mean? The big question is, will Bibi's provocations vis-a-vis the Arabs will have the opposite effect of taking them out? That's what Ayman Uda's been claiming.
Right.
That there's going to be a huge turnout in the Arab sector. Well, maybe yes, maybe no. We'll see how that... Well,
it's funny you say that's the big question. There's a party we haven't mentioned, which is the far-right Otzma...
Mayudit.
And this is just a feeling, and I don't pretend to be a political, you know, wise guy. I have a feeling that the people on the far right and the edge of the far right and a little towards not so far right are really going to turn out in big numbers. I have a feeling that they feel pushed to an edge, that look, they did
not allow someone to run, right?
They invalidated Ben-Ari, and they
let the Arabs run, and we all know the Arabs just want to kill us all and destroy the state, and how could it be, and etc. I am afraid, and these guys, if you want to talk about what scares me, these guys scare me. The far right, the Kahanists, the Baruch Goldstein guys, they, I think, are just about the most frightening thing out there. And I'm afraid that, as the polls seem now to be showing, they are going to get in, and they may get 5 seats, they may surprise us and get 6 seats, because I'm feeling, it's just a feeling that they're going to get their act together. There's no Feiglin to drain away those votes. I don't think Yamina with Shaked and Bennett interests the far right. I don't think many people on the far right, you know, the hardcore settlers. It makes me see how many there are like that. I don't think we know. Maybe better sociologists than me. No, I'm not sure we know exactly, and we're going to find out. I think I'm afraid that we might find out there are more than we think. I just did one more quick thing. The bone of annexation has been thrown to them, and I think they are going a little wild. I think it's a big deal that Bibi made that speech he made last week about annexing the Jordan Valley and settlements. It was a little unclear, but we really have moved pretty far to the right. If our prime minister can use those words, the word annexation appears more and more and more with each passing day. It seems now inevitable that we're going to go in that direction unless something very strange happens in this election. Because even Kahol Lavan seems to be willing to talk about it, to accept it, to think about it, which just proves that time does what it does. You know, time goes by and there's no solution. And the Arabs, every once in a while, kill someone and makes everybody angry. And so annexation becomes more and more acceptable and likely, in spite of the disaster that it will bring. So I'm afraid that bone has been thrown to the far right. They're excited. They say, we will vote far right to push Bibi to do what even he admits he wants to do. I could be wrong. I hope I'm wrong. We'll have to see.
I just wanted to say about Shimon said about this is a pretty brazen comment on my part about how stupid can people be. And one of the fascinating things, I think, is Shlomo, but as you know, sociological viewpoint is the Tzemet Chemed of Bennett and Shaked, leading the remnants of what was once the, when I even came here, the Mafdal party, which had people of stature and had a different security outlook, a whole different world outlook, was very, in a good way, kind of like bourgeois Haskalah kind of religiosity.
The 70s, can you go back?
They were older when I got here, but there was still that remnant in the Mafdal. They were around. And the thing that got me is Bennett and Shaked, their whole part of their campaign and their constant campaign is, you know, the bitachon of Israel is at stake. It's, we're in danger. Things are being badly run. We're being attacked. The rockets from Gaza, the situation in the north. Yet they're, and Bibi's doing a horrible job. Yet they're the ones who say there's no other candidate besides Bibi. There's no other one who can be prime minister. So I'm going, why are you voting for them? And I have to say, Bennett gave an interview. He didn't get really dinged about it. Like more than a month ago, he basically ruled out giving chasinut, immunity, to Netanyahu. Then he gave an interview which was shown on Shabbat. I don't know if it had the koteret, you know, filmed before Shabbat, in which he said, and this I thought was displayed the vision, the prudence, the acumen of not a mature, not exactly a mature politician, who said, well, in our current matzav, you know, we need stability, and I'd be highly willing to consider immunity for Netanyahu. To me, sort of basically destroying the fundamental, you know, nature of the state. I don't understand, like, this figure that you're basically attacking because the security situation and things are so unstable and so bad, and then you're saying I should give him immunity. Why? Because of the politics and the polls, that it's the voters support this. I mean, I don't think that he has like strong opinions on it. And another thing, talk about incitement. Did anyone see Shaked do another great video work in which she has pictures of the leading figures, intellectuals in Israeli politics in the past, and said, you know, like she has Leibowitz and all these people, and she said, despite the fact that they were on loggerheads, etc., on different sides of the fence. They were, you know, they knew about Yahadut and they loved Medinat Yisrael despite their differences. And now we have, you know, pictures of the hated left wing. Now we have Amei Haaretz and people who are basically Sonei Yisrael, who are anti-Zionist, hate the state and whatever. And you know, this is like Ayel Shaked, who grew up in Tel Aviv and has secular education. And she's an expert all of a sudden in Yahadut. And I'm going, is there no gvul? Is there not, is there no, like, nothing that, no restraint? Is there no line that you can't cross in sort of politics? Who's the one who's crossing the line and saying that everyone who doesn't agree with annexation, doesn't agree with right-wing policies, is a traitor to the state of Israel and is a boor in Am Haaretz, and basically delegitimizing them? We're going to talk about Rav Kook in a second, but basically saying, no, they're secular and, you know, Hem hotziu et atzmam me'aklal. They're beyond the pale politically. And this is who we're fighting against. This is the danger. Don't you think that's vile? I mean, and doesn't it disturb you that these are the people, the two people who, one person has said, I'm prepared to destroy the justice system and give someone immunity for what are serious crimes because it's politically expedient. And someone else is trying to say that anyone who doesn't agree with the annexation of the West Bank and our policies is beyond the pale politically.
Let's start with Noam. In terms of this,
you want to go to Noam?
I want to go to Noam.
Okay, so Shlomo wrote an article on Noam. He said, I think, in a very nice way, what people have been saying, and really got the point, explaining why this party came into being and what propelled it, right?
To a certain extent, but I want the point that Noam made explicit, and now Shaked after Noam made explicit, is I always used to say that the religious Zionists have no problem with secular people. Absolutely not. And that's on every level of a scale. They have a problem. They have a problem with leftists. They don't have a problem with secular. That's totally. And they're not even interested. Even Rav Jokman and people like that said, we're not interested in Chazorah B'Tshuva, like the Haredi. We don't care whether you personally put on tefillin or don't put on tefillin. That's not something that interests us. What interests us is that you should be ne'eman to Eretz Israel and then be ne'eman to all that. And eventually, if you're ne'eman to the Jewish people, if you're loyal to the Jewish people, and you're loyal to the state of Israel, and you're loyal to the national revival, so you'll understand that it has a religious basis, and that this is all a movement to come closer to God, and you'll understand that. And eventually, you'll put on tefillin, or your children will put on tefillin. That's the way the flow of history. That's the way the flow of history will go. So I think in a certain sense, you know, there's a sort of pining of the religious people for, you know, Efa Bachorot Ela Makuku Vasarafan, right? You know, where are the good old secular people that we used to know in the Palmach and people like that? They killed Arabs, you know, with the zest that we and that was very nationalist and the reaction, you know, the reaction here, they're explicit. If anybody read Rav Levinstein in Makor Rishon on Shabbat, so he was very explicit. He was saying that, you know, all these people he quoted Michel Foucault and he quoted Jacques Derrida and he quoted, well, I don't know how well he knows them, but he needs those, knows their names, and he knows enough to, you know, to quote them. You know, the enemy is postmodernism, and the enemy is, you know, fluid sexual identity, fluid gender identity, and cosmopolitan liberalism as opposed to nationalism. So Shaked had picked that up. Shaked had taken the cue from Noam and said that, you know, that on the Hefech, that the religious Zionism is based on partnership. We're not barbarians. We're based on partnership with the secular people. We've done this for the last 100 years since they founded the Mizrahi. But the question is, which secular people? I mean, secular people and they understand that, you know, that nationalism is like gender. It's a natural thing. In other words, for a person to love his own is a natural thing. If you don't love your own, there's something wrong with you. You know, if you don't have an instinctive loyalty to your kind, you know, and that's even biologically based. There's something wrong with you, and that's what, and I think that, and that was the substance, I think, of that video that she made, and she picked up on that. I think she's responding to what she perceives as a sort of halchei ruach, as a type of attitude that's her constituency. She's become mainstream, and this is, I mean, Bennett and Shaked and Smotrich and Harav Rafi, as they seems in Haranof on Shabbat, you know. Oh,
Smotrich or Rav Rafi?
Rav Rafi was in Haranof on Shabbat.
He must have got a hero's welcome. I mean, you know.
No. Feuerstein went nuts against him.
Oh, he first invited him to the shul. He spoke.
Avremi Mittelman invited him. Excuse me, I don't know if this is going to be on tape or not.
It's okay. This is great stuff. Okay.
Avremi Mittelman invited him, and Feuerstein was adamant that he shouldn't talk in the shul.
Key.
Because Feuerstein thinks that Smotrich, with his talk about Medinat Halacha, has undone 15 years of work on the part of Tzohar, that Judaism is not about coercion, and Judaism believes in personal autonomy, and Judaism is panim sochakot, is friendly and inclusive and warm.
He's right. He's right.
And Smotrich, you know, with these comments has just wiped it out, and he doesn't want. I don't know who he's voting for. I don't know how he's voting. I don't know what he's doing. But that's what and it was held. As a result, he gave a talk on Saturday afternoon in Middleman's house, not in the Dati Leumi. That's a pretty big deal. I mean,
it's a pretty big deal that the Rav of the Shul had the omitz, personal omitz, to do that. Maybe I don't know, but I think that video, to me, the tone of it, the content. I just don't understand how people. I know I'm sounding emotional, perhaps irrational. I can't let it pass. You know, it gets worse by the moment. And people think that it's not going to lead to any violence. There will be no consequences. That there will not be one-upmanship. You know, if Shaked does X, then someone has to do X plus one because you have to beat Shaked. Yeah. And so they're more Yamina than Bibi and Noam and whatever are more whatever. So I find it like indefensible. I don't think it's the language of political debate. It's beneath contempt, but certainly worth noting.
Yeah, look, I very much like what Shlomo just said. I like your article very much. Look, postmodernism has been, you know, the bad guy in a lot of religious circles for a long time. I know Rav Shagar, who I don't know well, I don't know his work well, tried to address that, tried to incorporate that. There are others. Dafka Inmakori shown, the former editor of the Musaf Shabbat, Yoav Sarek.
Yeah, he
often had stuff in there.
Berkowitz.
Dov Berkowitz. Sure. There's a lot of very. Yeah. There are people. I'm shocked at the fact that there aren't more people doing the Jewish thing and showing how we can square this circle and we can make this work. Because in many ways, postmodernism is rooted, and many people have said this, people like Derrida, had a Jewish background, is rooted in the way Chazal dealt with text. You know, it's I once held in my hand a book by Derrida with holes punched in it, as if to show I can do anything I want with the text. I was in Waterstones in London, and I should have bought it. You know, it was a lot of money, and it had holes in it, so I didn't buy it. I should have bought it. So I, for many years, without knowing that much about, you know, Foucault, there's a Foucault I teach. He wrote a monograph on This Is Not a Pipe, Magritte, and I do that, but with Rav Nachman, Avoloch Hashuv. It's, of course, it's an idea, and this is very cookie, and we can embrace a good idea is always, you know, has problems with it, and some stuff worth thinking about. And I agree with Leon that people have somehow lost an ability to go, well, I see a point about this, and I see a point about that, but I think you're wrong about the other. And again, I come back to what I said earlier this evening. It's way beyond what's going on in Israel. It's going on all over the world. Mm-hmm. Here, it's exceptional that if you take a left-wing stand, you're all of a sudden against Israel. And I used to say, you know, in America, to Americans, I used to explain, look, what that guy just said,
isn't so terrible. People in the Knesset saved, and they go to the army, and they send their kids to the army. And now Israelis have somehow forgotten that sentence. They go to the army. They send their kids to the army. How can you tar them with this brush of you anti-Semite Jew and you anti-Israel Jew? I understand someone who says, you're crazy to want a two-state solution. They'll kill us all. I really understand that. I make my shikul, and I say, no, I think the demographic threat is worse. We have to have two states. But I don't think the people who say it's a danger, it's an existential danger, you're crazy to think about it. I don't think they're nuts. I think they're wrong. And I agree with Leon. For the life of me, I guess I can understand it. Some people aren't so clever. They can't think it through. But I agree with you that it's horrible that these people have to immediately make it a zero-sum game. It's got to be totally dichotomous. It's all black or white, good or evil. And they're unable to, let's incorporate some of the ideas and see if we can come up with something interesting.
Well, let me just say something about the Israeli public. And that's, according to Pew 2016 Israel, 6% of the population, the Jewish population of Israel, is willing to identify itself as left. 14% of the Chilonim, in other words, the Chilonim, you know, 1% or 2% of the Datiim is willing to do that. Yeah. And of the Chilonim, who you would expect, you know, like, you know, so sach hakol, 14% of the Chilonim are willing to do that.
I want to say that that's also, I think, a function, a large degree, of Bibi Netanyahu and Zichrono Levracha, someone by the name of Finkelstein. Wasn't that his advisor, one of his advisors? Yeah, his guru, American guy. It worked to say, well, if you're a liberal, turn it into a dirty word. And that was
not willing to accept it.
And that was a very big...
I got to tell you, I've seen it as my job to announce that I'm a liberal with a capital L and a capital Lamed to Americans and to Israelis, and to proudly say that the last president I voted for was George McGovern, and they didn't listen to me, he's not president. And I think it's our job. It's our job to push against this idiocy.
But I'm saying that this is not a shift only in the religious public.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's a shift in the general Israeli public.
Yes.
I want to come back to something that Shimon said. This is the penultimate topic. We'll make it a small topic, but it's a really important topic. And Shimon was talking about Rav Kook. He just mentioned, you know, his attitude towards secular Jews, which of course is very positive. Even I'm not a Rav Kook expert, but basically he saw them as part of kind of this historical dialectic they were going to bring about. They were the kind of the working class, as it were, that was going to bring Am Yisrael back to Eretz Yisrael. And then we were going to have the Geula, and they were a vehicle of good and not of evil. And they were to be loved, and they were, Am Yisrael, etc., etc. And I saw an article in the Times of Israel by Rabbi Joseph Blau against people like Otzma Yehudit. And I want Shlomo to comment on this and then talk about Noam. And what he basically said, and it was very well written, very diplomatic, much more diplomatic than I would be, more persuasive. He basically said, no, Rav Kook got it wrong in the extent that, as I read the article, it was a messianic movement. In other words, Rav Kook based his kind of Jewish philosophy on a messianism. And that messianism, when you have messianism, people want to... people want to, you know, pull the wagon so that it gets to its intended destination. And when they do that, you have sometimes very bad consequences. And in this case, you know, we have to have, on the right, we have to annex everything, we have to get rid of the Arabs, and we have to kind of have this kind of denouement where we get to kind of this result. And I think that Shlomo wrote his article on Noam, and I'll just preface, Noam's campaign was homosexuality and alternative lifestyles are a danger to the state of Israel and family life. People with Naftali Bennett and Shaked, you know, Oketz against them, Reform Judaism, women at the Kotel, the barbarians at the gates. And then the question is, what led to all this? So Shlomo wrote an article on this, and I want him at least to disagree with me with respect to what Rav Blau said.
Yossi Blau's article.
Yeah.
Somebody sent to me Yossi Blau's article Rabbi Yossi Blau's article in the Times of Israel. I think it was a blog in the Times of Israel.
I'm
not mistaken.
Mashkiach at YU.
Yeah, right. And so I want to say something like the opposite of what you're saying.
Okay.
And that is that... and here I'm going to plug somebody else's book, a colleague of mine, Shaul Magid, has a book out on Rav Kahana, which is coming out any month now.
Okay.
He sent me chapters and what he emphasizes is that how anti-messianic Kahana was, and that this element of in Rav Kook, this dialectical element, this element of openness, that's tied to Rav Kook's messianism, and that's tied to the messianism. What you call the messianism is tied to the dialectic, that Judaism is going to change, that we're going to have this partnership with secular people, and we're going to become more open, we're going to become more interested in social justice, we're going to become physical,
the real world.
We're going to get out of this hidebound, sectarian, particularistic Judaism, and we're going to go, something's going to happen.
Okay.
And Kahana represents what certain researchers have attributed to the settlers, but I think was not necessarily true, but I think it is true, of the so-called disciples of Kahana, of Itamar Ben-Gvir, and those people, it's a sort of neo-Haredi stance, that this is what the Torah says, the state of Israel really has no legitimacy, but if they kill the Goyim, it's fine, that's what they exist for, and if they wreak vengeance on the Goyim, it's fine, and the state of Israel has to be run according to Torah law. And if the Arabs don't like it, we'll just get rid of them. And this is what the Torah says. And there's this openness, this dialectic quality is totally gone. And I think that's what's happening in the religious community on the extremes, is that the messianism, the messianism which had an open aspect to it, had a liberal aspect to it, had an
openness to change,
willingness to change, is dying out. And it's becoming fundamentalist in a Haredi sense.
But can it still be messianic, fundamentally messianic?
I mean, Kahana, maybe, but it's a different sort of messianism.
Okay, in
Hachinam. It's a messianism, it may be, it's like Rav Ginsburg made the distinction between Rav Kook and the Lubavitcher Rebbe, that Rav Kook was, he very famous drasha of Rav Ginsburg, he's very creative, Rav Ginsburg. He's my favorite dark theologian. Mm. Shades of Harry Potter, you know,
right.
What I mean? Rav Kook was like Shmuel Hanavi, who anointed Shaul, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe is like the one who anoints David.
David,
because when the real Messiah comes, he's going to do coercion. He's going to be imposed Torah law in a coercive manner. And they're going to exile the Goyim, they're going to do Torah law in a coercive manner, and it's going to come sort of, like Haredim as Iran.
Yeah.
We're going to have more day b'malchut, and they will be treated accordingly.
Yes. Yeah. And that's a deviation, that's a collapse of the Kookian system, etc., etc. So I see a theological issue here, that the Kookian system is at the edges starting to fray.
Okay.
And that people going in a Haredi direction. Okay, I spoke too long.
Yeah, no. I agree, and I would even take it further. I think it's all over. In terms of the openness and the willingness to let's think positively about evolution, and let's think positively about this, that Rav Kook wrote about and talked about, I think it's as good as dead. And I know Shaul Magid, and he was a Talmud of mine, and I am not saying he's a Talmud Shesarach, but we disagree about almost everything. I think his approach to Israel in general is wrong, but I've seen some of the stuff about Kahana, and there's a lot right there. There's a bit that I would emphasize more about.
You know, do you remember me? Do you remember Kahana from New York?
Sure, you know, as a tofa'ah, I was never close, I was never involved, I always looked at it askance a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think, and I'm not such a fine schmecker, I think a little bit on aesthetic, for aesthetic reasons.
Okay.
The whole thing seemed creepy to me.
Okay.
And Yossi Klein HaLevi's wonderful book, Memoirs of a Jewish Extremist, emphasized for me what I didn't like about it.
He was a class younger than me in TA. Yeah,
TA, of course. And you TA guys were always rougher, tougher, and aesthetically not like us Long Island guys. So, okay. Those of you out there who know what I'm talking about, you know what I'm talking about. But I want to look at it from a somewhat different perspective. And again, I'm going to connect it to a worldwide phenomenon, which is this bloody-mindedness, this just orneriness that is at the core, I think, of Trump's base. Let's just smash it all. Nothing's any good. We hate everything. Trump is like a cartoon. Trump is relevant here. Trump is like a cartoon villain. He wants to destroy the forests. He wants to kill deer. I mean, really,
It's all true.
It's unbelievable. And millions, tens of millions of people like it. So this nihilism, this drive to Thanatos, this death wish, he's unleashing all that. And in terms of the Jewish right wing, the Datilumi right wing, it's the same damn thing. It's an unleashing of the darkest possible bits of messianism, of Jewish identity, of Israeli identity. And it has to be fought. It has to be fought tooth and nail. I want to say something about messianism. I find it remarkable. I've said this about Chabad a lot. They quote the Rambam. Chabad is very big on the Rambam. Is la halacha. This is how Mashiach will be. And they think they understand step A, step B, step C. And they all seem to ignore that the same Rambam and the same Hilchot Melachim says, of course we don't really know what this is going to be like. Right. And everything I said here is just different chazals, and there are a lot of metaphors here, and we won't know till it happens. So someone who claims to be a Talmud Chacham, and claims to be a frum Jew, and know, only seems to know the bits of the Rambam that sort of reluctantly, I would say, anyone who reads Hilchot Melachim, there is a reluctance there. The Rambam reluctantly says, well, it's supposed to sort of go like this, and then emphasizes, but we don't really know. And then, like a Rav Ginsburg, who I want to say Yimach Shemo. I want to say it about him. Like Rav Ginsburg, pretend to know step by step, we're here, we're there, we have to do this, we have to do that. They're morons. They're not from Jews. They're not Talmidei Chachamim. If I could excommunicate someone, I would excommunicate them.
It always seemed to me that Smotrich, when he talks about Midrash HaHalach, he sounds like an Amoritz.
Oh, no, Smotrich, I think he's both a phony Talmud Chacham and from a yeshiva guy, and a phony tough guy, because he barely served the army.
But he, according to, I think, the former assistant head of the Shabak, was caught with, I don't know, was it an enormous amount of gasoline that he was going to put on put on the Ayalon after the Hitnakut.
In 2005.
And apparently he would have been prosecuted, but they had to burn an important source. That was the story I read. Yeah. And they didn't want to, you know, like they'd have to call in a witness and that would burn the source. Yeah. And they couldn't convict him.
This is the kakakracy.
Yes. I just want to say that to me, I don't know. I mean, I can pat myself on the back, but I'm not, because it's so depressing. When I came here, and my son was in Gdam Hova in Kiryat Moshe, a hotbed. That was, you know, the neighborhood of Merkaz Arav. And they were going to do the Hanukkah play. And the Hanukkah play, I tell the story all the time, was the Ganenet told the students this was about our fight against the Arabs. Yeah. Like, oh, yes, I'm not making this up. This was basically, she gave this lecture that Hanukkah is just like in the same way that we fought, you know, we the Maccabim fought. So the Avanim were fighting against the Arabs. And this to me, like, was through a big red light. And afterwards, you know, I started referring to them, Chas v'Shalom, Merkazians, as in someone who comes from like a different planet. But to me, and to me, I totally agree with Shimon. It's so depressing to be, I think, a religious Jew these days in Eretz Yisrael. And about the fact, you know, I keep on thinking sometimes too that so much of it's perhaps, you know, on one hand, we come from this, you know, America, Canada, university education, and we don't see a conflict between good secular values and good religious values. We want to harmonize them. We want to take the best of both worlds. We want to be the best we can be. And on the other hand, the Israeli kind of religious establishment, you talk about this Haredi kind of element, or a very strong Haredi element. It is a very strong Haredi element, because going to university is bad. And having women politicians, unless they can bring you votes as head of the list, and unless they make alluring commercials, is generally a bad thing. That would be bad, except when it serves your political interest. Then you're willing to engage in all this. So, I mean, it's a very, I'm in a very bad place. Thank God, I don't think it's affected my emuna in many ways. It's like strengthened it. I just go, I am in such a small minority. I feel in an incredibly small minority with very little
I feel very support. Bad for young people right now. Very bad for young, dati kids. Who are they supposed to look up to? Who are they supposed to listen to? Who are they supposed to?
That's another schmooze. But I'm going to interrupt. I just got to interrupt because we're going on. I'm just going to say that. I just want to say one thing with Shimon. I always say that, you know, I won't say other leaders of different faiths who I look up to with regard to no possible element of their dogma, like what they happen to believe, what they do not believe, but just as personal examples. You know, the Dalai Lama seems to be, on the whole, admirable type of person. And I will say, if I was to say, quote, other figures, I think it would be too controversial, at least about sometimes their personal midot. They've displayed good personal midot. And we don't have one single person, like universal figure in the Orthodox Jewish world who everyone can say, you know, this person we can really look up to. I mean, there were people in the past, me, Rav Lichtenstein, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and you didn't have to agree with every single position. You could say this is a person beyond reproach. You know that they would never do anything that you could possibly criticize in any way. We don't have it. And not only do we not have it, we see them taking positions and saying things which are, to me, sometimes beyond the pale. And as Shimon has said, are indefensible, I think, from a Talmudic classic Jewish point
special,
of view. From the Mikorot and distortion of sources on issues. And it's okay. So now I want to get to, just quickly, scenarios. Does anyone, I'm not talking about predictions, is it going to get better or is it going to get worse? Let's say there's only two scenarios, which is Likud wins by a very small minority,
yeah.
Or we're forced into a third election, or the third possibility is there's some type of coalition that's, you know, between Lieberman and Likud. Lieberman at the last moment goes to Likud, or Kahol Lavan, Likud and Lieberman get together, best guess, and just a line, a quick, you know, three sentence comment, is this good or bad for the Jews? I mean, I know it's putting people on the spot, but, you know.
Look, clearly, what the electorate would seem to want, although I don't think they articulate it, would be a broad coalition between the Likud and Kahol Lavan. That's, you know, the bell curve, the Venn diagram, I don't know what it is. But if you look at it, that's sort of the center, it skews a little right, doesn't skew very much left, frankly. And then you have, you know, people who are seen as certainly pro-Israel and pro-defense and pro-security and, you know, strong, good people who most people trust one way or the other, except for Yair Lapid, who everyone loves to not like. So although everyone's swearing it's not going to happen, it's hard to see how it could in terms of the corruption charges against Bibi. But I'd love to see that. I'd love to see people come to their senses and figure out a way to put the two basically centrist parties. On the contrary, if a few wackos on the right of the Likud would peel away and jump ship, all the better, you know, if they would still have a majority. All the better.
Shlomo?
It's not inconceivable, given the way Israeli politics, all politics, and Israeli politics has worked, that Gantz wakes up on the 18th of September and says, you know, a coalition with Netanyahu is a possibility. I mean, it's true that I've spoken to you about against it for the past 6 months consistently.
Things have changed.
Things have changed. You know, as they say, what we see from here is, you know, what I see from there. So I wouldn't rule that out, by the way. I think that a narrow coalition would be a disaster. I really do. I mean,
A
right-wing coalition. At this point, in every way, would probably be a disaster, both for rule of law, both for religious, non-religious relations,
annexation,
on any scale. I can certainly live at this point with a national unity government of this sort. I don't know how that would play out in the Likud. I think that there's a lot of resentment against Netanyahu in the Likud. Mm-hmm. I think many of the leaks that have come out in the past week or so, you know, their source was in the Likud.
Look, they're all ambitious people.
Yov Kara, the tapes came from him. I think there's a lot of resentment against Netanyahu and his imperial style.
It can't go on that long, that kind of style.
Right.
You're right.
It really could. So I don't know what can happen there. I'd like to go a little bit off topic and just provide, just tell you about my trip to the United States and provide a little bit of perspective. I don't know what you want to do with this perspective, but I met two people. I met the guy sitting next to on the plane. The plane from Tel Aviv to Boston is the last leg of the plane from Mumbai to Boston.
Mm.
They fly from Mumbai to Tel Aviv. Mm. They're 100 people
The high-tech flight?
I don't know if it's a high-tech.
Mumbai's, okay.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's a high-tech flight. Right. The guy I was sitting next to is a student in one of the universities in Boston, and he was an engineering student. And yeah, so, so I met him. This guy's a Sikh. He's a supporter of the BJP. He's a big supporter of
the Nationalist Party in India.
The Hindu Nationalist
Party,
In India, he's not a Hindu. He's a Sikh.
Right.
But he's a big supporter of the BJP, big supporter of Modi, and a tremendous admirer of
Bibi Netanyahu.
Here we go. And I met, I was at my brother's house in Massachusetts, and he's an older person and not well in certain respects. I'm not going to go into it. And he has a person with him and his wife the whole time, a person from Brazil. And she was a supporter of
Bibi
Bolsonaro.
Right.
In Brazil. Oh,
Bolsonaro in Brazil.
And an admirer of Netanyahu. So I just wanted to say that if Shimon was talking about international currents here,
but let me
et cetera, et cetera.
Thank you for sharing. Let me say something. The world really is going crazy for a reason. It's all changing. It's all up for grabs. I think people sense that climate change is serious.
Right.
People sense that tremendous numbers of human beings are moving in unprecedented ways because of technology. They're able to move more quickly than the Indians made it over the Bering Straits. I think the entire world understands that we're on the cusp.
Yeah.
And AI and robots, we could go on and on and on and on.
Right.
And it's nervous-making. It really is nervous-making. And you sort of, circle the wagons and strengthen your identity. And there might be something healthy. I think there is something healthy about that. I'm a certified Anglophile. I have a certificate from the Queen. She should send me one, but I'm a certified Anglophile. I think the Brexit people are out of their bloody minds, but I get it. I understand who are these, wogs and these frogs in Brussels to tell us how to live. I get it. So I think your stories are important, and they speak a truth about we're living in very, very difficult and problematic and scary times. I just read the new Ian McEwan, Machines Like Us, AI and about humanity and responsibility and et cetera. And it's a good book. It's not its best, but it's a good book.
It
deals with a lot of these issues. And we're really on the cusp of very big changes. Of course, it's nervous-making.
Okay, I just want to say thank you to my guests. I think it was a really good podcast. We don't know what's going to happen in the election, but it's going to be exciting.
We don't.
And
what are we doing then?
And
why are they paying us all this big money here?
Yes, and I think it's going to be one of the, a very important election, just like the last one, and we may have another important election
very soon.
And I think we really the Chinese were right. We really are, to a certain degree, living in interesting times. So thank you very much to Dr. Shlomo Fischer, my co-host and compatriot who helps on the podcast, Rabbi Shimon Felix, and who's also great on the podcast. Thank you very much.
Jeff.
Okay.